Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven back with us once again. Scott's been with us for, 30, 35 years or so. It's not his first time around. Anyway, we can talk hunting and fishing. We talk about birds, frogs, now making their presence known, other wildlife, and, of course, want to hear from you. You've got some questions, I'm sure. You may have some observations, things that are going on in your neighborhood. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Scott, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Well, it's great to be here, Larry. It's a beautiful day out. Spring has sprung, and as you know, if you're interested in wildlife, spring is the time. Everything's out there and active. So
lots going on out there right now.
Lots going on. Lots of birds coming back. Just this morning, I had an indigo bunting at the feeder. First one I've seen this year. My grosbeaks got back 3 days ago. What else was happening this morning? It was a gobbler turkey displaying in the backyard in full strut with two hens. That agitates me for other reasons, but I'm trying to think. A hummingbird came back this morning, too, according to my wife. So things are really jumping.
Things are moving right along. And, of course, the fishing opener this weekend.
Fishing opener is on Saturday. Of course, we've had such lovely weather off and on that the early trout fishermen have been out thick. So opening day for trout does not have the thrill factor that it used to have. But, hey, it's still another opportunity. Plus, people have been out after panfish, and a very odd fish has gotten a lot of press lately, sturgeon.
Yeah.
Sturgeon have been in the news for a variety of reasons, but they deserve their own treatment here in a minute or two. But
New regulations that people ought to be aware of, some new limits and so forth, especially walleye.
There are a lot of things coming up. For example, one biggie, tomorrow the DNR board apparently has an emergency meeting to discuss the opening or potential opening of walleye fishing on the Minocqua chain up in the North Woods, which has been a really contentious thing for, I think, 9 years now.
Yeah.
With the closure that was agreed upon by the DNR and the public and the tribes and in terms of co-management, but apparently, there was a tribal declaration that they might very well spear the Minocqua chain. I don't think that's happened yet. At least my contacts have not told me it has. But the DNR is still apprehensive about that, so they're preparing the necessary paperwork and bureaucracy to declare, if that happens, they would declare open sport fishing on walleyes in the chain, beginning, I assume, on Saturday, which is probably why they're meeting tomorrow. So that's been a big deal. Some of the limits and so forth that you're talking about were just recently voted on at the Conservation Congress hearings. We can talk about that later, too. The one that took me by surprise was at the Fishing Expo here in Madison back in February. I was wandering around looking at all the tackle and whatnot, and there's a big sign on the DNR exhibit. Anglers, be alert. The perch bag limit on Lake Mendota has been reduced to 10 fish. And,
it's 10 total with perch or bluegill or, some combination of all those fish.
I understand some of the rationale, but it was that was a bitter pill to swallow. As you know, I've been in Madison now for 50-plus years, and perch have always been just kind of the gold standard of fishing in the Madison area, dating back to first the limit was 50. And my wife and I would go out, and some nights we'd catch 100 perch, and usually that was enough to take care of freezer needs for the season. Then it went to 25 and now 10. And that's okay, but, can you really put on a fish fry for the family with 10 panfish? It makes me wonder a little bit about the fine balance between support for what seems like a good idea and what's practically doable or acceptable. But anyway, so it is, 10 fish bag limit, and that's been imposed on other lakes. And I understand there are some good results that size structure is improving and so on and so forth. So
the one thing that worried me about that was then people, well, catching a small one and throwing it back, maybe it dies because
there are lots of ins and outs of any of these things that hopefully are thought through before they're imposed. But we'll see where it goes.
Fred in Madison emailed to say the last time you were on, you mentioned creating a water feature in your yard, and it is a really pretty, I've seen it, it's quite nice. Fred's considering doing the same thing, would like to know more about what Scott installed. What wildlife are you trying to attract, and what advice do you have for people wanting a water feature on their property?
Wow. Well, I mean, first and foremost, I'd say, without question, it's the single best management activity, if you want to call it that, that I've conducted on the 12 acres. So my backyard's a little larger than the average yard, but as a matter of fact, I should point out that on June 15th, I'm doing a program at Wild Birds Unlimited on the west side of Madison on what I've done on that property for the last 25 years. And then I'm going to invite the participants over to my place that afternoon to actually walk around and see those things, including the water garden. And so that's a good segue into.
Yeah,
but anyway, back to the water feature. I've had them for years at other properties. Some I've dug myself and have been DIY. And, you know, they worked okay, but they weren't that durable and so forth. They accomplished my goals. But this time around, I went to a professional landscape group and said, you know, they came out and said, hey, here's the spot. I'd like this. I'd like that. I'd like a waterfall. Oh, yeah, no problem. And they came up with computer-generated drawings or sketches of we could do this or we could do that. I said, this is what I want. And I just let them go for it. And they, of course, had the heavy equipment that I didn't have. They could bring in big boulders that I couldn't do.
Yeah.
And the result of the whole thing is a very attractive water feature.
It is.
And my goal was to provide water in an area where there was otherwise none other than a bird bath or something like that. And therefore, I could accommodate some reptiles and amphibians that I might not attract otherwise, some birds. And right now, for example, we've got a pair of mallards that come in there every morning, just like clockwork. They come tearing over the prairie, whomp, splash down in the pond, and they're a source of considerable enjoyment right now to watch those ducks behaving. So the pond provides you an opportunity to attract some wildlife you otherwise would not get. And it's a water source as well. Two turkeys came in for a drink this morning, and it's cool seeing them up close. I'm sure the deer use it at night, and so on. The pond itself is about 8 by 14.
Yeah.
And then there's a three-tiered waterfall and little stream that they did with the dirt that they took out of the hole and landscaped it beautifully and put in a pump. So there's circulating water constantly. That works extremely well. There are some interesting water plants. I mean, that's the other thing. If you're interested in gardening, you're able to deal with some aquatic plants that otherwise you couldn't deal with. So there are water lilies and cattails and irises and things like that. So it, I won't say it was, it certainly wasn't as inexpensive as doing it yourself by digging a hole and putting in a flexible liner. But for me, it was well worth the money. And there are lots of people that do this, and you can decide. You just want, you know, 2-3 feet of surface area and a small fountain, or do you want a substantial pond? I mean, they can put them in up to an acre or more. Most yards can't handle that, but I guess the point is, for the caller who was interested, it gives you a lot of opportunities that you wouldn't have otherwise. It's really cool at night, on a warm night. The doors are open. You can hear the water flowing and trickling and so on. The frogs are singing now. The animals are coming in close to get a drink. It couldn't have worked out much better.
I agree with you. It's a beautiful sight for sure. Chris in Franklin had a question for you. You mentioned ducks, so we'll go there. Chris, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, yesterday we saw down below in our yard two mallards and a female duck, and they all kind of were standing around having a committee meeting or something. They looked distraught. And then I went later on down to look myself, and I found her nest was all broken. All the eggs were broken, and there was a lot of fur all over. It must have been quite a fight. But we, have no eggs left. She has no eggs left, so there's nothing to save. But I'm wondering, is there any way we can protect it in the future? It was in one of our bushes. And also, yeah. I'm wondering, what the heck got it? Was it a coyote or... There was a lot of fur.
Probably a raccoon.
Yeah, public enemy number one is probably a raccoon, but it could have been a possum. It could have been a coyote. It could have been a stray dog. It could have been any number of things. But depredation on waterfowl nests like that, especially if it's a first-time nesting mallard and the nest was pretty exposed, is almost a sure thing. But, you know, they have 10, 11, 12 eggs, and if a couple nests out of every dozen or so hatch, then we've got enough mallards to replace that that generation. So it's a fact of life. In terms of what you can do to protect one in the future, if you can find the nest, or if you know where she's nesting and are watching, then you could consider, I would say, some types of fencing, a single strand of electric wire high enough off the ground that the duck could go under it, but a raccoon might get zapped and think better about their intentions. But all of that's a little iffy. I mean, yeah. It's a long shot. The best thing to do is give them good nesting habitat. If there's, depending on what you have in your yard, there's some good tall vegetation left over from last year that maybe you could have left for an extra couple of weeks to provide some nesting shelter and then clean it up a little later in the growing season. Those kinds of things in the long run are probably
about all you can do.
About all you can do.
Thanks very much, Chris, for that call. Christina in Glenwood will go to you. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. This is so timely because this past weekend, I had out-of-state guests visiting, and as we toured our beautiful state, they kept commenting about all the dead deer on the roadside, and I said, well, if Scott's on, I'm going to call him, because we feel this reflects poorly on Wisconsin, and I'm wondering, why are they left to rot?
Yeah. There's some money question there.
It's a financial thing, and I think often the decision is county by county, and the contention is that, hey, we don't have the budget to dispatch a county truck every time somebody calls in a deer. I can be sympathetic, Christina, as I drive Highway 39 or the north-south route from Madison up to Minocqua pretty regularly to get up to our cabin, and, you know, going through areas like Westfield and so forth, that's a hotbed for deer highway issues, and it's not unusual, if I were to count, to see 10, 15, 20 carcasses. Some of them may have been there for a couple of months,
yeah,
and are in various stages of decomposition. But I understand that people don't necessarily like to see that. But the only suggestion I can have for you is that that's a matter of going through local politics, through, you know, maybe the state could weigh in on it. Maybe it's a citizen-generated question for next year's Conservation Congress that the state urges the counties to do something differently, or the state highway department weighs in. But otherwise, it's a matter of the county board saying, yeah, we need to do this. This is offensive to a lot of folks visiting our state. And I personally don't like to see anything on the side of the road, whether it's a discarded beer can or a fast food wrapper or anything else. But a deer carcass in various stages of decomposition is no better.
No.
So I'm not sure what to tell you, Christina. I don't think you're alone, and you'd be rather they're not there. And I don't understand that if there's a public works truck going down the road,
yeah.
I mean, they're right there. Either throw the thing in the truck and get rid of it, or have somebody drag it back in the bushes where it's not visible. I'm okay with it being used by scavengers like eagles and crows and so forth, but move it out of the sight line.
Yeah.
So,
I would say the county board, whoever's your county board rep, that would be the person probably to call, because those are county-by-county decisions.
Yes, and it's not really a wildlife issue that you can pin on the DNR or the public or whatnot. It's a community issue. It's an eyesore issue. And I think it's the county board or maybe something in state-level government to help you out.
Thank you, Christina. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, our guest, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Always great to have him come by. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Joel Patnod, our producer today. Jeff Robbins, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin, on the show today, Larry Mueller with my guest Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Always great to have Scott stop by. And questions, give a call or shoot us an email. Lots of emails. Actually, Steve emailed. He called, couldn't stay with us, wonders about the reemergence of white pelicans on the Fox River. Says he hasn't seen any juvenile pelicans, so he wonders if they're maybe not year-round residents.
Well, the resurgence started about, 10 or 15 years ago, maybe longer. There were some huge colonies out in the prairie states, in the Dakotas and whatnot, that were for some reason disrupted, and all of a sudden these hundreds or thousands of birds started to turn up in other places, including Wisconsin. And they're present in some very large nesting colonies in several places in the state, from Green Bay down to Horicon and some places in central Wisconsin. And that's where they're nesting. As far as I know, they are nesting in the state, but there are scattered flocks moving around, just like you see scattered flocks of geese. I came by Dunn's Marsh on the south side of Madison on the way in this morning. He's like, wow, what are those big white birds out there? And it was a group of 10 or 11 pelicans just kind of hanging out. So they're not going to nest in a place like that, but they're around.
Thanks very much for that question. Appreciate it. Now, we did talk about limits. There's a daily limit for walleye on fishing of 3, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's going to be more of a statewide consistent regulation.
Yes.
And that I'm all for simplification and consistency when it comes to these regulations, because it's tough to keep track of.
Now, turkey hunting is underway. The DNR has been asking hunters to think about what they're wearing. And you got camo gear, you've got a turkey, couple of decoys out there, and you're calling like a turkey.
I learned that lesson firsthand on Thursday morning last week, but I'll get to that in a second. You're right. Today is the first day of the third of 6-week-long hunting periods. So this is period C that starts today. A and B are over. D, E, and F are coming up. As it goes along, there's less and less interest because the turkeys are less enthused and the vegetation makes it more challenging to hunt. But this is prime time right now. The birds were very active this morning when I was out around the house. And I hunted the last period and was singularly unsuccessful. But the most notable thing out of that, I had my chance, but I did not succeed. But anyway, that's a part of the long story. But on Thursday morning, my decoys were attacked 3 times by coyotes, which has never happened to me before. Now I'm sitting, 20 feet from the nearest decoy, and what's that coming up on the edge of the field? It's looking kind of sneaky. And it was a single coyote to start with, and the animal progressed to within about 20 feet of the decoys and then didn't smelled a rat and took off across the alfalfa field. Next one came in from a different direction and it got about 20 feet from the decoys and then launched itself in midair with its jaws wide open, and it was just about to clamp my $100 Jake decoy, and I said, I can't have this. So I yelled, which is not a good thing to do when you're turkey hunting. But anyway, the coyote did a midair 360. It was really interesting to see. And he took off in another direction. And a half an hour later, another one, maybe one of the first two, came by and made the same stalk on the decoys. And I was calling. I assume the coyotes are known for being reasonably clever. And I'm sure that they heard the calling and said, oh, turkeys for lunch. And Oh, yeah. There they are, standing there in that field, and they're not moving. So I understand how it happened, but I was a little surprised they were that bold.
Scott in Madison has something going back to the dead deer, I believe. Scott, hi.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to add some more information on the Carkill Deer Program. For deer that are on interstates, U.S. highways, and state highways, that actually is administered by the State Department of Transportation, not by county government. County government would be dealing with the deer on their county trunk highway system.
Okay.
For listeners, if you see a dead deer, contact the county, the non-emergency county sheriff's department. If it's in the traveled way, sure, call 911. That would be an obstruction and an emergency. But when they call, people should know then those contractors, which are mainly private providers, not county highway departments, there are a few, they have 2 business days to pick that up. One of the problems is they can drag that deer off to the side into the right-of-way and let it rot. They're supposed to use vegetation, topography to hide that, but they can abandon that deer within the public right-of-way, which I think is actually bad because with CWD, we're supposed to responsibly dispose of those, but again, it is a cost issue for people to landfill all of those. But I wanted to kind of add that to the record.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. That's useful information. I didn't realize there was a distinction between road or highway type and who is responsible, but it doesn't change the fact that some public entity is responsible.
Yeah.
And if their independent contractors are not doing the job, in other words, by concealing the carcass or physically removing it, then maybe it's time to find a new independent contractor.
Yeah.
I know that may not be the easiest thing in the world, but I'm glad you brought up the notion of we need to be more concerned about chronic wasting disease and anything that might be detrimental in terms of its spread. But another problem that I don't think gets adequate attention is if the animals are just off on the shoulder a few feet, they attract all sorts of scavengers.
Eagles.
And then eagles, I don't know how many times driving north now, it's unusual when I don't see an eagle perched on a deer carcass, sometimes, you know, 8-10 feet from traffic doing 70 miles an hour. So this is, some of those animals are being killed as secondary mortality because of the deer kill. That's also a very unfortunate thing. So the bottom line is, whether it's aesthetics, human sensitivity or sensibilities, CWD, risks to scavengers, there are a lot of reasons why it seems like we ought to be able to get those deer carcasses moved out of harm's way or moved, period. And I don't know about the finances. I'm sure that's an issue, but
yeah, it's got to be done.
It seems like it's got to be done.
Scott, thanks a lot for that information. That was great information to have, and we appreciate it very much. Kevin emailed to ask if there are any recent studies on the impact of the growing numbers of white pelicans on the sport fishery. He said for several weeks this spring, hundreds of pelicans have been feeding below the De Pere Dam on the Fox River. DNR says they eat about 3 pounds of fish a day, each one. Kevin says they watch some lucky birds scoop and swallow 2 walleyes at a time. Other photographers have clear open-mouth shots of a single pelican with 3 walleye in a pouch.
Good grief. What next? I wonder if those pelicans have been made aware of the new reduced bag limits. Well, that's an interesting observation. I was going to make the uninformed comment that hopefully they're concentrating on rough fish, but apparently not if photographers are getting pictures of a pelican pouch full of walleyes.
I don't know that there's been any research on
I've not seen any particular research on the impacts. We kind of went through the same thing for years with the double-crested cormorant population and their depredations on perch up in Green Bay and newly stocked salmonids and along Lake Michigan shoreline, and that seems to have lost some of its steam. I don't know what to say about the pelicans, whether they ultimately are going to have to think about some dispersal or harassment issues to get them away from concentrated fish, but certainly I can see where sport fishermen may get agitated about that as the word spreads.
Last year, there was a big drop in the deer harvest by hunters, especially in northern Wisconsin. And, you know, there are a lot of regional challenges. You know, you think about the state and, you know, the various regions of the state. There are a lot of regional challenges to managing deer in this state.
Yes. You know, on the surface, it seems like a relatively simple thing. Well, the deer are out there. If we want less, we shoot more. If we want more, we shoot less, and so forth. But when you start to throw in the North Woods concerns about winter severity index problems and depredation or predation caused by a variety of species, now wolves get most of the press and blame, but don't forget about the bears and the coyotes and the bobcats and so on. So there's plenty of blame to go around. So there's a couple of huge issues that are Northwoods related, but not a concern down here in the Banana Belt.
We got 1.6 million deer in the state right now, but the numbers in the north are down.
Low. So, you know, down here, we've got chronic wasting disease to worry about, and we should be worried about that. That's a big threat, and it isn't going away anytime soon. And we've got problems with the redistribution of hunter numbers who have, whether it's to avoid CWD or there's just fewer, I don't know. But hunter numbers are a concern down here. CWD is a concern. Agricultural damage remains a concern, as well as highway mortality. And, of course, access to private land. In the north, it's mostly public land, or a lot of it is. Down here, it's mostly private land. That's another big issue. And the metro units. Then you get up into some of the central part of the state in the farmland areas, you know, Waupaca, Shawnee, that kind of thing. They seemingly have, no matter what they do, they've got deer coming out of the woodwork and can't seem to harvest enough to get that issue under control. So, yes, there's a lot of variation from region to region and even county to county, and worse yet, within counties that are bisected by ecological boundaries or whatnot. Which is why I'm hearing more and more people calling for a restoration of the old or of some version of the old numbered deer management units that made sense ecologically and could be identified by road boundaries, rivers, or whatever, as opposed to county lines. The county issue was an artifact of the Kroll Deer Trustee Report of 2012, and we've been dealing with it. But I hear more and more people thinking, wow, this is just complicated things rather than simplifying them. And I don't know about anybody else, but I find county lines kind of hard to see on the landscape.
Yeah.
I know if I'm on County Highway A or Interstate 39, but I don't know where that big red stripe goes that separates Dane County from Iowa County. So we'll see whether any traction occurs on that matter. But yes, the observation is certainly correct. There's a lot of variation across areas and even within counties.
And we've got the county county deer advisory councils, CDACs,
well,
they're called.
That was another recommendation in the deer trustee report, and it has proven to be a useful tool in terms of public input or user input to the DNR. But again, it's based on counties, and that, again, carries with it some difficulties. The CDAC meetings just concluded in the last week or so, where permit levels that would be authorized or recommended, any changes in hunting strategy, like are you in favor of the holiday hunt or the muzzleloader hunt or whatever, all those discussions were just recently had. I'm part of the Dane County CDAC, and you know, we go through the motions, but in our case, our problem in Dane County is that we're constrained by access to private land, which is very difficult. The metro unit, which is the bulk of the area in Dane County, and the fact that manipulation of tags to harvest more deer has no meaning because we can't sell, or I suppose give away, the number of tags that we have, or have to offer. So, you know, some of the tools that were available in years gone by, like earn a buck and special doe hunts and some things like that that were essentially deep-sixed by legislative action. Without some of those more aggressive tools, some of the CDACs have their hands tied. And the ones in the north that are dealing with wolves and winter kill and so forth.
And bears.
And bears. I mean, hey, good luck, guys. I hope it works out for you. But it's a tough nut to crack.
You mentioned wolves there in passing, but Dan emailed to ask you to comment on the current status of the wolf population and whether there are any updates on delisting them.
Well, the updates on delisting is that everybody's trying. I was just talking to some folks in my department on campus before I walked over here, and the heat for delisting tends to settle either in the DNR's chair or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife chair. And in fact, both of those agencies would like to see them delisted. But where the decisions are coming from are from our court system, from judges who may be hundreds of miles or thousands of miles removed from the actual wolf population and are just listening to briefs from the people. The wolves need more protection to, we've got too many wolves, something's got to be done. And then they make a ruling. And it may be, you know, maybe it's really after keen interest in the facts, and maybe it's, well, I feel sorry for these wolves. And I don't know. But
yeah.
It's being made by decisions, often individuals, not the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and not the DNR. And until that's somehow changed, or the right judge happens to come up, or no, I shouldn't say right, a different judge comes up who maybe interprets the facts a little differently, and all of a sudden they're delisted. I don't see, as I look at the numbers and the fact that wolves are doing very well, I certainly believe strongly that the state is quite, our state and probably others in wolf range are quite capable of taking over wolf management. Therefore, delist them and give control back to the states. Then we can actually do something. Otherwise, everybody's just spinning their wheels and getting frustrated.
Christine has something different. Christine in Evansville. What's on your mind, Christine?
Good morning. Well, first I have an observation. 3 days ago, overhead in Evansville, I saw a flock of white pelicans, and I would say there were probably about 30 flying in a V formation, and I believe they were all juveniles because I didn't see any black on the wingtips underneath. So that was just an observation I wanted to share. And then my second question may seem silly to some people, but when we have really, really heavy downpours of rain and frogs and toads are out all over the place, especially on the roads, I'm always worried because I feel like I'm running over them left and right. And is there some kind of frog or toad, like high-pitched whistle thing you can put on your car just like they do for deer? Is there anything that you can do so that you're not hitting frogs and toads?
Holy mackerel. Well, that's an interesting question.
The deer
question.
Whistle doesn't work, by the way.
The deer whistles have met their own challenges over the years. There's certainly nothing you can mount on your vehicle. And even if a frog had the mental acuity to, whoa, here comes a car, then to execute that maneuver to get away from the car, not going to happen. So the fact that they're out. The same thing happens with salamanders. With warm early spring rains, when they are headed back from where they've overwintered to their breeding ponds, and in certain areas they're killed in large numbers on slick roads. And the same thing happens to frogs going or coming from their breeding ponds. It's a sad byproduct of our dependence on cars. And the number of vehicles, the number of miles, you know, something that moves as slowly as a toad or a snake or a turtle can't cross too many busy highways in its lifetime and survive the experience. It's kind of, what was that video game? Frogger, I guess it was.
Yeah.
It's just not, on average, it's just not going to happen. And that has to be taken into consideration in management of these populations. They build some underpasses. They put up warning signs. They do what they can. But unfortunately, all I can say is if you feel personally, if more people take some personal responsibilities, whoa, this is a good night for frog migration. And I know there's a wetland down the road. I'm going to go to the grocery store in a different direction or something. If more people started to think with that kind of attitude, or we developed some type of an alert system that, I can't imagine we get a weather alert, for example, on every radio station when we're going to have a big storm. You know, maybe it's time for a passing note that, hey, folks, you know, here it is, the third week of February. It's going to be a really warm, rainy night tonight. Be careful out there. The salamanders are going to be moving. If you know there's a pond near your house, you know, watch out for it. You know, maybe something like that would save a few animals over time, but that's a big stretch with the things people have on their minds right now with the election and the economy and a million and one other things generating more concern over movement of frogs and salamanders is probably a tough sell.
Yeah.
But that's what it would take. But no, short answer to your question, there's nothing you can do with your car to avoid hitting some on a rainy night other than not getting in your car.
Yeah, there you go. Let's hear, Jeff's probably got some spring peepers. We're hearing them tonight, this time of year. Jeff, you got a spring peeper for us? Yeah, there they are. Thanks, Jeff.
You know, that's one of 12 frogs and a toad that we might be hearing over the next few months. Oddly enough, I've not heard a spring peeper yet. I've had lots of chorus frogs, lots of toads. The spring peepers are usually very early, but, you know, whether there was something about the winter that was detrimental for them or drought for the last couple of years, I don't know. But that's a very common call, and it's one people recognize easily. But right now it's the cricket frogs and toads that are really cranked up, and then we'll get leopard frogs and tree frogs and a few others. And the animals progressively join or drop out of the chorus all the way through midsummer when the bullfrogs and green frogs are singing. So
we got a chorus frog? I don't know. Jeff, have you got one of those? I can't remember if you have one of those. No chorus. We got some tree frogs, I think. Yeah, let's listen to a tree frog. Oh, here's the chorus frog.
That's the chorus frog.
Yeah. Yeah?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're little tiny guys. You can hear them, but we were talking about the water gardens and so forth. I can hear what sounds like hordes of them in my little pond, and it is the size of the table we're working at here. And you go down and look for them, nothing doing, can't see them, and if they hear you, whoosh, all of a sudden they're all quiet.
Let's listen to a tree frog. We'll go out on that.
Yeah, that's a nice call.
You know, I'm pretty sure that gets confused with a lot of other things. And actually, the chorus frog sounds like a cricket. Can sound like when you get a bunch of them going at the same time, it sounds like a crickets mm-hmm. too. A lot there. Well, on that note, we're going to remind you that you can join in with your own questions. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. With Scott Craven, you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here as we take a look at the world of wildlife with our guest, Scott Craven. Scott, Emeritus Wildlife Ecologist, UW-Madison. Great to have him back. Just a quick note, this week we're celebrating World Press Freedom Day, which is Friday, May 3rd, actually. But right now, all donations to WPR will be matched by a group of generous donors, up to $30,000. Their way of encouraging you to support Wisconsin Public Radio's trustworthy and independent news. So you can join in now at WPR.org/donate or call 888-202-2552. And Scott, before we get back to the calls, sturgeon have been in the news. Sturgeon have been in the news a lot in the last couple of weeks.
Well, they have, and part of that was because of a petition from the Center for Biological Diversity to make the case that sturgeon should be on the endangered species list as a threatened species. But that was just recently rejected by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they determined, nope, sturgeon populations are doing really well. And, of course, the folks in Wisconsin take great pride in the fact that sturgeon are very intensively managed and doing very well. So then we also, at the same time this was going on, we're seeing reports of the big crowds headed up to the Wolf River and other places where they spawn to view the spawning activity along the shallows of the river. And that, of course, means that there were volunteer activities for people who serve as sturgeon guards to keep watch on those known areas of sturgeon concentration. DNR can't have a warden on every bend in the river, so people volunteer to watch over them because they're very vulnerable to poaching or illegal activity while they're spawning like that. So that got a lot of news. And then, of course, you know, a couple months ago, the sturgeon spearing season on Lake Winnebago and Butte des Moines and so forth got a lot of publicity because it was at risk of not being held because of lousy ice and other conditions. So that always attracts a lot of attention. And, in fact, there's an opportunity to continue the celebration because at the DNR's Wild Rose Hatchery, there'll be a Celebrate the Sturgeon spawning observation opportunity this coming Saturday on May 4th. So don't miss that. There'll be a big crowd. And there's also been some incredible movements of sturgeon documented. They're since they're heavily studied, a lot of are marked and tagged in various ways with electronics. And the most recent one was a Wisconsin fish that apparently moved from somewhere in central Wisconsin along the Mississippi River. Or actually, I guess it went from, I forget which river it was on, but it passed through three dams, went through Eau Claire, found its way out into the Mississippi, and then passed through, I think it was 21 or 23 dam and lock situations to end up caught again, found by researchers, yeah, between Illinois and Missouri. I think it was 651 miles south of where it left its home water. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that kind of stuff is just amazing. And then lastly, I guess if people, those movements and a lot of other neat facts about sturgeon were documented in a recent column by Pat Durkin, an outdoor writer that I know, yeah, you've had on the program. Pat's a good guy and really does his homework in generating these articles. And you can find the one he just wrote on lake sturgeon at patdurkinoutdoors.com, all one, yeah, word. And that was
good,
a great column on if your interests are piqued by sturgeon. And then that movement got me thinking about, you know, all the other things that people hear about and marvel at, about, you know, mountain lions wandering across from the Dakotas all the way across to the eastern United States and certainly into Wisconsin, long distance travel by wolves, you know, all sorts of things.
The speed of travel got to me, well, whether it came to mallards.
Yeah, that one got a little publicity, too. This was a case where a mallard duck that was, trying to remember where it was tagged. It was tagged by people at Tennessee Tech University, and they were following it. It had a GPS tag on it, so they knew where it was. And it was somewhere over Minnesota. They were following its migration. And it took off, headed north toward the Canadian border, and it made 600 miles in a little under 8 hours. And the top speed they recorded was 99.3 miles an hour. You know, almost 100 miles an hour, which is faster than a major league, you know, hardly any major league pitcher can throw a fastball 100 miles an hour. And that's what that duck was doing. Now, when they checked the weather records, it had a very strong gusty tailwind up to 40 or 50 miles an hour. But still, he was, I mean, I can imagine that duck looking down and saying, holy cow, Minnesota's disappearing in a hurry here. There are things like that that come up constantly when you pay attention to the things wildlife are capable of, and it makes it all interesting to think about.
It sure does. Gail in Bancroft has a question for you, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Gail.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about piebaldism, specifically here in some resident goldfinches that my husband and I are seeing at our bird feeders. So last summer, I noticed two male goldfinches with fairly stark color variations. One, instead of the black kind of French beret sort of cap, had a very light lemon-colored head. A second one had a white tail, entirely white tail, with one kind of big black freckle in it. And this week we're seeing another male with an entirely white tail. So I've named them Lemonhead, Freckle, and Buck.
Very good.
I don't normally name birds at our feeders, but it's kind of a useful, quick identifier. So my questions are, or I'd appreciate any explanation you can give about piebaldism in birds, how common this is, how the genetics are operating, and especially whether this affects attraction to mates. Like, does it make it harder, or is it maybe an advantage?
No.
And I thank you in advance.
All right.
Wow, that notion about breeding activity, and is that male better off because he's known as Lemonhead, or is he disadvantaged in the system? I don't know about that. And I would urge Gail to do a little digging by doing a Google search on piebald issues and then get a much clearer understanding of the genetics and percentages and so forth than I can give. I'd offer a couple things up, though. One is that sometimes what you're seeing, rather than being piebaldism, leucism, some type of albinism or whatever, is replacement feathers from some type of damage or feather loss. They'll sometimes come back in different color, different tone, different shade. And that might explain some of what she's seeing. But piebald, or sometimes called partial albinism, is known from a variety of species, birds and animals. And piebald deer are well known in some areas where they're partially white and partially normal coloration. So it does happen. It is genetically based. I can't really comment on the frequency of it or whether if she's got lemon head, white, I can't remember the names now, but anyway, they made good sense. Three or four individuals exhibiting some degree of white or off-color coloration, whether that in the local population is going to grow in frequency or whatnot, I don't know. But I think in terms of the underlying genetic cause and the prevalence, I think a Google search would turn up exactly what she's looking for.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Dick in Black River Falls will go to you. Hi, Dick.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just have a brief story about a pond like Scott has, probably. It's only the size of two kitchen tables, but it was a lot of fun. And one spring, all the ice in it melted, and so it was all water in there. And then we had a snowstorm, and the next morning, the snow had stayed on the pond, but then there was a brown streak through the middle of the snow, about a foot wide, and kind of reddish, kind of furry, as it stood out, and it looked like a kidney bean shape. And where all this kind of this brown streak through this white snow, right in the middle of the pond, it's like something I've never seen before.
Oh.
It was just cute.
Well, I can't offer up much of an explanation there, Larry. Why don't you take this one? It does sound like an interesting variation, but did you go down and look at it closely? I mean, what was it? Was it some discoloration of the snow? Was it actually an animal of some?
It was just the discoloration of the snow. There wasn't any animal connected to it. Right through the middle of the pond, and it was like this reddish, about a foot wide, and kind of like furry, you know, like. But it was like 6 feet long.
Huh.
Well,
I suspect some wind pattern or something that blew some dirt across or leaf debris or something. But anyway, what? It's one of the reasons to have all these features around. You never know what you're going to see.
Sarah found a, as we're getting to the top of the hour, Sarah found a dead skunk on their rural property. The skunk's remains were intact, but the internal organs were gone. Wondering what could have caused that. What could have eaten the internal organs of a skunk? Could be a lot of different things.
Well, it could be a lot of things, but it was if it was just kind of lying off by itself, did she say it was hit by a car? Was that the,
no,
don't know. It was just dead.
Rural property found dead. Yeah. Hmm.
Well, I'd suspect some type of a, you know, even shrew, anything from as small as a shrew up to weasels and
owl maybe,
or even a bird that may have pecked its way into the soft body cavity and made off with, for crow, for example.
Yeah,
lots of possibilities.
Scott Craven, our guest, he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today to take your questions and comments, and you can join in again. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take that look at the news, and then we'll be back with Scott. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, UW Emeritus Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Great to have him with us today as we talk about the world of wildlife. Scott, I know you wanted to mention elk hunting because there's a May 31st deadline, of course, coming up, so just a month yet this month.
Well, there's a couple things, Larry. Yes, the application period is now open for an elk tag for Wisconsin. The change this year, or the opportunity, is that the central Wisconsin herd, centered around Black River Falls, will be open for the first time. The tag levels haven't been set yet, but you know there'll be a handful. But it's the first opportunity to hunt in that area. So the applications are due by the 31st. It's $10 a pop for the application. They've been handling over the last few years 20 to 25,000 applications for 10 or less tags. Not great odds, but most of the money goes to elk management, so it's a good thing to do anyway. And if you draw one, it's considered kind of the hunt of a lifetime. Success rates have been very high because people who draw a tag have time to do their homework and get out there and figure out where the animals are, and it's a big deal. The herds are doing very well with calf production here coming up. I think they figured the total state herd will be up over 500 animals. So it's gone a long way since those animals were sent over from the lower peninsula of Michigan back in 1995. And then they had another infusion of Kentucky elk. But the bottom line is the hunt began in 2018, and it's very popular. And you've got until the end of the month to get your oar, dip your oar in the water, so to speak. So,
Dale in Hudson has something for us. I believe, or is he still with us? Oh, we lost Dale. Joseph in Wauwatosa will give you a chance. Hi, Joseph. Joe, are you there?
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Joseph, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Am I on the air?
Yes.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay. This is Michael from Wauwatosa. Anyway, I just had a couple quick comments. One was on the pelicans, and I just wanted to say, let's not forget that they were extirpated from the state because of the concerns of the fishermen and the pelicans taking too many fish. And there are some of us that would much prefer to see a flock of pelicans than have a string of fish. I just wanted to bring that up. And there's a lake north of Anago called Pelican Lake. It's a pretty large lake, and it hasn't seen a pelican on it in over 100 years. So I'd love to see them back.
Fair enough. They're spectacular birds. I enjoyed seeing that flock this morning on the way in, and I don't think there are any fish in the marsh that I saw them on. So they,
there you go.
No harm, no foul.
You also had another comment, Joe.
Scott Michael mentioned you hadn't heard the spring peepers. And I went to school in UW Stevens Point, and I used to go out and listen to the peepers, and it was a thrill. every spring. And over the years, I started believing that their numbers must be decreasing and decreasing and decreasing, and it was pretty depressing. And I'm 63. A couple of years ago, I got a pair of hearing aids. And oh, my gosh, they're not decreasing. My hearing was decreasing.
Uh-oh, I'm going to hear about this when I get home, because my wife will bring up my hearing aid situation. But I'm pretty sure I can still hear peepers if they're out there. But anyway, thanks for bringing that up, Michael. And good luck with the Pelicans.
Thanks for calling. You know, we've sort of mentioned in passing the spring hearings from the Wisconsin Conservation Congress spring hearings, always in early April. And I think we had 19,000 people respond to the annual questionnaire.
Yep.
What were some results that stood out in your mind?
Well, I mean, first of all, the Congress itself is a real exercise in democracy, I guess, in terms of providing input into the wildlife management or the natural resources management community. So thanks to the 19,000 people who made their input known either in person or online. There were a couple of things. I went through the results this morning and said, well, these are maybe the bigger things that people would like to hear about, because they were either statewide initiatives or, you know, it wasn't a matter of can we keep 14-inch bass on Blueberry Pond in some county?
Yeah.
It was. These are more general. So, for example, one that I think was potentially important, that there's been some talk about hunters being allowed to process a deer, or at least break it down into quarters to get it out of the woods and leave the inedible parts behind. And that notion in general was approved by about a 4-to-1 margin. There was another one on elimination of landowner preference during the spring turkey hunt, which I thought was kind of a big deal. It was a nod to the fact that a lot of these turkeys are on private land, give the landowners a break kind of thing. That was approved with a yes vote, but it was darn near even Steven in the vote. That surprised me a little bit. There's some controversy about the use of technological devices like LiveScope 360 and other things that some people feel give fisher persons an incredible advantage, and it could be in the long run detrimental to the fishery. And that was are those things okay in all Wisconsin waters? And the vote there was about even as well.
I saw
so
that.
There are a lot more people thinking about that kind of thing. And, you know, Lee Kernan, who was the director of fisheries for the DNR for many years, is retired now, but writes about these kinds of things. And he had a very impassioned column in Outdoor News a couple of weeks ago dealing with all of these technological advantages, which have pushed the balance, in his opinion, in favor of the fishermen over the fish resource, and in the long run could be detrimental to Wisconsin fisheries. And there have been a lot of positive comments about that line of thinking. So that was an interesting one. There was one about lead ammunition. Should it be eliminated by 2030? And that was a no vote, which surprised me a little bit, too.
I couldn't believe that when I saw that.
That surprised me a little bit, but it was about a 7-to-6 margin, so it was close. But I thought, you know, lead is on its way out.
Yeah.
It's inevitable, but it's taking forever and a day. I thought, I was surprised by that one, too. Let's see, what else did we have? This is an interesting one. I didn't realize this was coming up, but the question was largely, do you support the DNR forming or creating a very an active awareness campaign on the impacts, detrimental impacts of outdoor cats? And that was a yes vote by a 4-to-1 margin. With that, more on that later, perhaps. And then there were just a couple of other ones that were of interest. The notion of reaching out, again, directing the DNR to reach out to power line companies and tell them, hey, lay off all the mowing on those power lines during the nesting season. It's bad for bird nesting, it's bad for small wildlife, and it's bad for native plants. And there have been a lot of people talking about this kind of thing, and including another popular outdoor. We mentioned Pat Durkin, but Tim Isley's been really behind this campaign because he has a power line running through his property, and he sees what the mowing does in a detrimental sense. And there was another interesting one on access across railroad tracks. That's been pretty contentious over along the Mississippi, and that was approved by a 10-to-1 margin. Let us cross over those crazy railroad tracks. But anyway, and then lastly, restrictions on wake boats.
Yeah.
That's generated a lot of concern on our smaller lakes, and that was a yes vote. Yes, restrict those things on small lakes or anywhere in proximity to shore by a 3-to-1 margin.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, that was the result of the some of the spring hearing. You can get all those results online now. It just came out 2 days ago on the DNR website.
I went down the list and looked to see where the votes were close or they went the other way. No, it was, and you hit most of those. That's good. Emmanuel in Madison, what's on your mind?
Yeah, so having a situation with a woodpecker that he keep coming every spring about 5:45 a.m. and hit the inside of the gutters and knock that gutter like a hammerjack or something. And I wanted to kill that bird, but you know, I can't kill it. But what's going on with that bird? Keep coming every spring.
Well, in a way, you're lucky, and I'll explain why in just a second. But from the woodpecker's perspective, it's just like the turkeys gobbling or the pheasants crowing or the bluebirds singing. It's spring breeding activity to let their potential mates know, hey, I'm over here and it's spring, and then things proceed from there. For a woodpecker, anything that makes a racket that they're hammering on, whether normally it's a dead or hollow tree or a tree limb or whatever, their hammering is a message to prospective mates that it's the breeding season, prospective competitors that, hey, I'm here and you better not be, kind of thing. And this particular bird, and it's not just you, they figured this out a long time ago, that hammering or pounding on, not that anybody knows what a TV antenna is anymore, but it used to be TV antennas, downspouts, aluminum soffit, whatever, makes a real racket. And the more noise that bird can make, the stronger that message, the signal is going out over the surrounding area. So he's just doing what comes normally in the spring, and I realize it can be annoying, but there's not a great deal you can do about it other than kind of grin and bear it during the breeding season. The reason I said you were lucky is sometimes they do that pounding or hammering on the side of a wooden-sided house, and they can do considerable damage. Whether they're doing territorial drumming or looking for insects in the siding, they can really tear up a house. Yeah. The stuff on a downspout or whatnot is annoying, but it's not really damaging. So, you know, you can go out and scare it, clap your hands, whatever, and run it off. I realize that's troublesome at 5 o'clock in the morning, but that's really about all you can do, but it won't last long.
No, it won't. It's still going on in my neighborhood. I get up at 5:30 and do a jog through the neighborhood, and there's a couple of trees every year in different parts of the neighborhood where those woodpeckers are banging away at around 5:30, 5:45 to 6. And it goes, you're right. After a bit, it's gone.
You know, it's just one of those things that happens in the spring.
Mary Kay in Kenosha. We'll go to you. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi. I'd like to talk about Wisconsin protected species like frogs and salamanders and other species, and how we shouldn't be disrupting their habitats.
Yeah. Well,
there's no question about that, and it doesn't have to be, you know, simply the species that we don't think about all that much. Habitat is the key for every species. If you don't have a place to live, you don't live.
Yeah.
And the habitat needs of these wild species, whether they're amphibians or reptiles or birds or mammals or whatever, are really no different than ours. They need some shelter, they need food, they need water, and they need some security. And every time a new house goes up in what was an agricultural field or a woodlot, or every time we decide to move the city limits out a little bit and create a new shopping mall or widen the roads or whatever, that takes up habitat. And it's not a force that's easy to stop. But if we do what we can to preserve things like this notion of no mowing under the power lines that we just talked about as an initiative by the Conservation Congress, or the fact that it's National Wetlands Month right now for the month of May, and people hopefully are becoming more aware of the value of our wetlands, whatever wetlands they may be, then, you know, hopefully the situation gets better, but there are more and more people all the time, and development is not going to stop, at least I don't think it is. So we have to do a better job of protecting and enhancing what we have left. And people can do that on an individual basis. As I mentioned earlier, the program I'll be doing in June on, you know, what I've done on my own property, which was former intensive agriculture, but certainly doesn't look like it now, people can adopt those kinds of strategies, or at least piecemeal. Or the people who have talked about putting in a water garden where previously there's just another patch of mowed lawn. All those kinds of things improve habitat for something. Putting up nest boxes, feeders, leaving a dead tree in the corner of the yard instead of just thinking about it as firewood. All those things collectively, if people become more aware and more sensitive, in the long run, help. But in general, slowing down development or the expansion of human population is not an easy thing to stop. And now you superimpose climate change on top of that, and it really gets tricky because things are changing where we have essentially no control. Yeah. So anyway.
There we go. Tim in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Yes, you were mentioning lead shot for hunting, but when I fish, I'm trying to find a substitute for lead split shot. I'd rather not use lead, but I can't find anything. Do you have any ideas on that?
Yeah. Bass Pro.
I think if you go to the Bass Pro catalog or
they've
online or Cabela's, which is owned by Bass Pro now, or Dick's or Shields or any of the good
sport. Eagle Claw's making them now.
Yeah, any of either the individual manufacturers that are making, say, split shot or sinkers or jigs in particular. You do see things like tungsten and other products coming coming online. So I think you can find it if you really dig. And there are programs in some of the big fishing areas, like when I'm working up in the Minocqua area, I see local initiatives to bring in your lead tackle and then switch it out for non-toxic tackle. I think if you dig around a little bit, you'll find an opportunity to make the switch. But you're right. We usually think of it in terms of firearms ammunition, but there may be more lead used in the long run in fishing tackle than there is in, don't know about that. But there's a lot used in fishing. There's a lot used in hunting. But getting the lead out, no matter where it's used, is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Tim, good luck with your search there. I just went online as we were talking, and I found a couple right off the bat. Bass Pro Shops, one of them, Eagle Claw, another.
Okay.
So they're out there, and they can be ordered via Amazon, because I went to Amazon for that. So have them delivered right to your door, which would be a good thing. Let's see. And Tim did email. Tim Isley did email, and he's really pushing private landowners. Power companies should work with private landowners. If a private landowner contacts a company, a power line company, they ought to listen to what the private landowner says about mowing or not mowing on those power line areas. Mike in Williams Bay emailed, he heard your presentation in Lake Geneva. he really enjoyed it and wanted to ask about your early experiences that contributed to your life work in wildlife ecology.
Wow. How much time do we have?
They only have just give us the 1 minute or 2 minutes.
So the 1 minute version. Well, you know, I was brought up in a time when kids were able to spend time outdoors with little concern for, you know, yeah. hazards. And so whether it was a vacant lot or walking to a park or a woodlot and catching tadpoles or chasing things around or doing the things that kids did, I was able to do a lot of that. And I had some cousins and friends who did the same thing. And then as I got older, my dad was an avid outdoors person, and fishing and hunting and so forth, and traveling to fish and hunt. You know, he was an avid trout fisherman. Trout live in really nice places. And I guess that kind of thing took me into the issue of animals and the outdoors. I was a zoology major in college and then realized, what the heck am I going to do with this? And I took an elective course in fish and wildlife management. And that led me to the fellow teaching it, recommending the University of Wisconsin in Madison as having a great graduate program. And I thought, I think this resonates with me. And I came here in 1972 and got my degrees, and the rest is kind of history, as they say. But it was that outdoor exposure, the kind of things that are brought up in Richard Louv's book, Last Child in the Woods, or Last Child in the Outdoors, whatever. Anyway, kids just... they're just not outside anymore. They're on their electronic devices. Even when I'm out with my grandkids hunting and we're sitting in a blind, if things get slow, they're on the phone, not watching for turkeys or seeing what songbirds are flitting by. They're on the phone. And that just seems to be a difficult thing to get around these days.
Tom Heberlein, rest his soul, always said he could tell if somebody was a deer hunter or not. He just asked him, "Did your dad hunt?"
Yeah,
pretty much. That was the determining factor. Excuse me. Well, here, that was a good. You did a good job at about a minute and a half, Scott.
Well, I enjoyed that talk in Lake Geneva too, so I'm glad you know folks enjoyed it as well. A beautiful place for a program. It was just wonderful.
Yeah. Well, where was it?
It was in Lake Geneva. It was in the Riviera Ballroom, right on the lake. It reminded me of the Kemp Station Boathouse. It was built out over the lake. Beautiful view. A nice crowd. It was a fun talk.
And your backyard seminar is June 15th?
June 15th at Wild Birds Unlimited in Madison, and they'll be coming out with their usual publicity on that. I don't know how many people they can handle, but we'll see what happens.
You can handle a lot on your property.
Yeah, I may need to get some crowd control going. I'm going to open a hot dog stand. And
I'll come over and give you crowd control. Scott Craven, our guest today. It was great to have him with us, and he'll be back in 2 months, and we'll do this all over again, maybe sooner. Who knows? You never know with Scott. The Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. We've been doing this together for, I think, 35 years, 30 to 35 years, so it's always a lot of fun. And I tell you what, tomorrow on the show, we're going to go to the United Kingdom to learn about regional food dishes from a cookbook author, and then we'll get some recommendations on places to visit while you're in England. It's going to be a fun show, and I'm looking forward to it. But you know what? There's lots more in store on the Ideas Network. Stay with us right through the afternoon. I'm Larry Mueller.